Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
Back in the late 1960s, if you were flipping through an issue of Fantastic Four or The Amazing Spider-Man, you might have come across a very striking full-page ad. Dominating the top half was a black cloaked man, his eyebrows arched, his expression fearsome. One of his hands jabs forward out of the cloak, the fingers spread in what was surely some deadly martial arts death grip technique. The other arm was pulled back as if about to strike like a deadly snake. His hair was coiffed in the perfect late 60s white guy afro, and his beard was carved into sharp points along his cheekbones. To the right of the image, written in ornate cursive lettering, was the name of this fearsome martial artist, Count Dante. The fact that his ad was in the middle of a comic book was perfectly apropos, as Count Dante seemed like a comic book villain. He looked like someone out of a Doctor Strange book, or perhaps Batman's Eastern nemesis Ra's al Ghul. The ad went on to proclaim that Count Dante was, quote, the deadliest man alive. The copy read, quote, Count Dante is the undefeated supreme grand master of the fighting arts. Count Dante won the World Overall Fight Arts Championship, master and expert divisions, after defeating the world's top masters of judo, boxing, wrestling, kung fu, karate, aikido, etc. in death matches. End quote. If you would only send $5 to the address provided, you could become a member of Count Dante's exclusive Black Dragon Fighting Society, whereupon you would receive a pamphlet written by Dante himself, where he would instruct you on the deadly, ancient, and highly secretive Eastern art of Dim Mak. What exactly is Dim Mak? Well, here's how a second ad would describe it. Quote, yes, this is the deadliest and most terrifying fighting art known to man, and without equal, its maiming, mutilating, disfiguring, paralyzing, and crippling techniques are known by only a few people in the world. An expert at Dim Mak could easily kill many judo, karate, kung fu, aikido, and gung fu experts at one time with only fingertip pressure using his murderous poison hand weapons. Instructing you step by step through each move in this manual is none other than Count Dante, the deadliest man who ever lived, the Crown Prince of Death. End quote. Now, these ads have become somewhat legendary among Silver Age comic book aficionados. The layout is so striking. The claims, punctuated by all caps declarations about disfiguring and paralyzing, are so grandiose. And the character, oh man, he's just so comic book perfect. If you're curious, I'll have both of these ads up on the website and on the Facebook page so you can check them out for yourself. But when you see these ads, you can't help but ask, who was this guy? And is any of this stuff true? Well, as it turns out, Count Dante was actually one of the 20th century's most colorful martial arts hustlers. Believe it or not, Count Dante was not this man's real name. The so-called deadliest man alive was actually an Irish-American tough guy from the south side of Chicago, born John Keehan. Kian had spent some time in the U.S. military, where he had learned combat jujitsu and karate, and had become enamored with Asian martial arts. When he returned to civilian life, he studied alongside and eventually partnered with Robert Trias. Trias was a fellow veteran who pioneered the instruction of Asian martial arts in America. Trias had opened up one of the first karate dojos in the U.S. and founded the United States Karate Association. But after a falling out with Trias, Kian went off on his own and completely reinvented himself as a kind of martial arts supervillain. In 1967, Kian legally changed his name to Juan Rafael Dante and started to claim that he was in fact a Spanish count. His family, he claimed, had fled to America during the Spanish Civil War and had to hide their identities lest they be pursued by General Franco. Now, the truth of this claim was highly suspect, especially considering that his family was clearly Irish and that Count Dante was also the name of the protagonist in the novel The Count of Monte Cristo. The change in name also came with a change in look. Kian started turning up at martial arts tournaments sporting a long black cape and carrying a walking stick with a golden lion's head on the hilt. His beard was carved into marvelous shapes and his hair was dyed pitch black. To add to the persona, Count Dante even managed to purchase a lion cub that he liked to keep on a leash and parade around the streets of Chicago. The guy was a character. But by all accounts, he was a legitimately gifted martial artist. Many who knew him would later tell reporters that he had excellent form and a real knowledge of several martial arts. But he was also a world-class BS artist who had a P.T. Barnum approach to self-promotion. In one particularly memorable stunt to promote his dojos in Chicago, Dante drove around town with a live bull on a flatbed truck, loudly proclaiming that he, the deadliest man alive, would fight the bull to the death with his bare hands in front of a live audience. But as the date neared and tickets started to sell, Dante changed his mind and decided, no, actually, my 19-year-old student, using the deadly skills I have taught him, will actually fight the bull. Then, when the day actually came, Dante emerged and told a disappointed crowd of onlookers that the event had been shut down by the Chicago branch of the SPCA. So sorry, no bullfight after all. Arthur Rapkin, the teenager who was slated to get in the ring with the animal, would later tell reporters that the SPCA had nothing to do with it, and that Dante never meant to go through with the fight. The whole thing was just meant to get his name and the dojo in the papers. As you might have already put together, Dante's title of Supreme Grand Master of the Fighting Arts was also completely made up. The World Fight Arts Championship that he claimed to have won? Yeah, that does not seem to have existed. Now, according to Dante, this was because the event was highly secretive as the matches were fought to the death. This was an illegal underground tournament conducted somewhere in Thailand. Actually, years later, another untrustworthy martial artist by the name of Frank Dukes would spin a very similar tale about an underground fighting tournament, and he even got his story turned into a movie starring Jean-Claude Van Damme. You might know it. It's called Bloodsport, and it is one of the most ridiculous films ever made. But there could have been no Frank Dukes and no Bloodsport had there not first been a Count Dante. But what about Dim Mak, Dante's supposed super deadly martial arts technique? Is that real? Well, Dim Mac, which is also known colloquially as the touch of death, is one of the more controversial ideas in martial arts. It's a system that allegedly works on targeting acupuncture pressure points on the body in such a way that it causes sudden death. Some experts, like physician and martial artist Dr. Michael Kelly, think it's possible, while skeptics have pointed out that there's no evidence that anyone has been seriously injured or killed simply from fingertip attacks on pressure points. Now, there was one martial arts writer, an Australian named Earl Montague, who would claim that Dim Mak was real. He believed that Dim Mak was a secretive form of old traditional Yang-style Tai Chi. Montague alleged to have learned the art from a mysterious Chinese master named Chang Yufeng, who was one of the world's last true adepts of the form. But here's the thing. No one has ever found evidence of Chang Yufeng having ever existed. Montague says that's because he passed away in 1978, years before he wrote his book on Dim Mak. And apparently, this man was also an illegal immigrant, so of course you're not going to find any official paperwork on this guy. So our best source on Dim Mak is a guy who had a secret teacher whose existence can't really be verified. So, you know, take that for what it is. So other than that, there seems to be no evidence that any traditional Asian martial art has a codified system of Dim Mak. In fact, the concept seems to have come from a genre of Chinese martial arts fiction known as Wuxia. Dim Mak, probably made up. As for Count Dante, if he had any knowledge of Dim Mak, he never really demonstrated it. His moment of martial arts notoriety would quickly fizzle after a violent fight at a rival dojo in Chicago. Dante and his students did a little dojo storming, an old practice where a group of fighters would turn up at a rival school and challenge the students to a fight. Well, Dante and his crew did just that, and the night ended with Count Dante being arrested and one of his best friends and students being stabbed to death with a decorative sword. Whatever you might think of Count Dante, Dim Mak didn't seem too much help to him that night. While the story of Count Dante and Dim Mak is certainly colorful, it's not completely unique in the world of martial arts. There's something about the hierarchical structure, the discipline, the deference shown to a master that lends itself to cults of personality. These disciplines, especially those derived from Asian tradition, often get presented as nearly magical. Count Dante created an elaborate fake history for himself, but as it turns out, creating fake history is all too common when it comes to martial arts. Many disciplines have massively exaggerated the age and pedigree of their practice. Other martial arts schools like to claim that they were founded by mysterious, mystical figures whose existence is often hard to verify. In some cases, elaborate systems of folklore have been developed to enhance the prestige of a particular form in hopes of attracting new students. When it comes to martial arts history, how much should we really take seriously? Let's find out today on Our Fake History. Episode number 124, What Are the Origins of Martial Arts, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the podcast that explores historical myths and tries to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week, we are dipping our toes into a topic that could really sustain an entire podcast all its own, and that is the history, or should I say fake history, of martial arts. As you may have noticed from the title, this is part one of what is going to be a two-part series on this topic. This is one of those that I thought I could wrap up in one nice, neat episode, but eventually it became clear that I needed at least two. Those of you that follow me on social media may have noticed that I teased that on this show we would have an interview with a very special guest. Well, that interview is actually going to be in part two. My special guest, I'm not going to tell you yet, but let's just say he's a podcaster and a martial artist. Those of you that are serious history podcast people have probably already put it together. But you're going to have to wait until part two to hear from that very special guest. So just thought I'd better give you a heads up. Now, in this series, I'm going to be examining a handful of martial arts traditions from Asia, specifically China, Korea, and Japan. Now, the reason I'm being so specific here is because many of us who aren't martial artists often casually use the term martial arts to mean Asian fighting styles, be it karate, kung fu, judo, or whatever. But I think it's important to recognize that martial arts aren't exclusively an Asian thing. Almost every culture around the world has developed some codified system of combat. In fact, some have speculated that martial arts may even be humanity's oldest form of art, period. Martial arts may even predate cave drawing or early forms of music. Now, there's no way to really prove that, but the logic is that play fighting, and of course, real deadly struggle, is something observed even in animals. So, even before we were fully Homo sapiens, our distant ancestors were probably rolling around in the dirt honing their fighting skills. Wrestling, boxing, grappling, these activities seem to be as old as the species. My point is, as soon as we broaden our thinking about what counts as a martial art, it very quickly becomes clear that these disciplines are as old as time and are hardly specific to one part of the world. But despite the primal ancientness of combat, and by extension, combat sports, many of the most popular forms of martial arts practiced today are surprisingly modern inventions. While disciplines often claim ancient roots, many popular Asian martial arts, like Taekwondo or Judo, were only developed within the last 150 years. Even the super ubiquitous art of karate, while potentially based on centuries-old forms, only really took shape in the late 1800s. Part of the reason I found this so surprising when I started my research for this series is that many Asian martial arts often get presented as deeply ancient. The more I dug, the more it became clear that this aura of ancientness rarely has anything to do with verifiable historical facts. In many cases, this was a deliberate construction. The quote-unquote histories of many martial arts are often a mishmash of legend and quasi-historical claims. Part of this seems to have been the result of the migration of Asian fighting styles to North America after World War II. Many of the first karate schools in the United States were founded by American veterans who had learned the practice while serving in the Pacific or while occupying Japan in the aftermath of the Second World War. When they returned to the States, many of these early American karate teachers promoted their schools by indulging in some good old-fashioned Orientalism. As I've mentioned before in this show, This is the phenomenon that was first labeled by Professor Edward Said in the 1970s, but it goes back millennia. Orientalism is a series of well-worn tropes and stereotypes about Asia that have been kicking around Western discourse since at least the time of the ancient Greeks. One of these Orientalist stereotypes is that Asia is innately mysterious, even magical. Where the West defines itself as scientific and committed to progress, Asia is presented as stagnant and rooted in unchanging ancient tradition. These early karate schools were happy to indulge in the magic and mystery of Asia and its arts to help drum up interest. Take, for example, American karate teacher Wallace Ruman, who ran ads in the 1960s promising to turn his students into masters of karate and claiming that, quote, "karate is the secret oriental art of self-defense that turns your hands, arms, legs into paralyzing weapons without any bodily contact," end quote. Claiming that karate, which was one of the most widely disseminated martial arts in Asia after World War II, was somehow a secret oriental art is classic orientalism, let alone the claims that it gives you the ability to paralyze people without any bodily contact. That sounds like some orientalist Asian magic to me. Now, it would be easy to blame martial arts mythology entirely on Westerners misinterpreting or romanticizing Asian practices. And while that certainly is part of the equation, it's not even close to the whole story. You see, Asia also has a long and storied history of martial arts mythmaking. Making your particular school of martial arts seem ancient, powerful, and mystical is something that Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and other Asian peoples have been indulging in for quite a long time. In fact, having a dubious origin story for your martial art is such a common feature, you might say it comes standard with most Asian martial arts practices. In the book Striking Distance by Charles Russo, the author quotes the martial arts historian Brian Kennedy, who tells us, quote, "The goal of most martial arts systems' histories is to give that system prestige, what the Chinese refer to as face. Some hope to impress the general public or prove that the system is combat effective, while others simply aim to inspire students of the system. Still others are concerned only with relating some interesting folktales. Truth rarely factors into the equation," end quote. Russo then adds, quote, "Scholars refer to this as invented tradition. By developing a compelling and often semi-mystical origin story, the school or style could draw new students by hooking on to their martial arts imagination. Essentially, it was highly savvy advertising," end quote. I like that. Fake history as highly savvy advertising. So let's take a look at one of these so-called invented traditions and see what we can discover. Today, we need to start with the granddaddy of all of them, the legendary origin of Kung Fu, and the Zen mystic known as Bodhidharma. Let's check it out. The martial arts system known as Kung Fu is deeply connected to China's Shaolin Temple and the warrior monks who call it home. Now, I'll be honest, the first time I heard of Shaolin was thanks to the Wu-Tang Clan. I'm sure a few of you out there might remember pressing play on 36 Chambers and hearing this.
Shaolin shadow boxing and the Wu-Tang sword style. If what you say is true, the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang could be dangerous.
I love that. The RZA took that little clip from the 1983 Hong Kong martial arts film Shaolin vs. Wu-Tang. But that's not the only martial arts film in which the Shaolin Monastery is playing a starring role. In the world of Hong Kong action flicks, Shaolin is synonymous with unstoppable martial arts. While its larger-than-life reputation may make the Shaolin Temple seem fictional, it is a very real place. The Shaolin Temple, or Shaolin Monastery, both terms are used, was established sometime around 460 AD. Now, aside from its reputation as the birthplace of Kung Fu, it's also deeply associated with a very specific branch of Buddhism. This is the meditation-heavy practice known as Dhyana in India and Chan in China. But it's perhaps best known to the rest of the world by its Japanese name, Zen. Now, I'm going to keep using the term Zen just because I'm assuming that's the term most of my audience is familiar with. But just remember that the Chinese called this practice Chan, and that the name Zen wouldn't be applied to it until a few centuries after its supposed creation. So I know I'm being a little anachronistic here. I just figure most people have heard of Zen. The legendary founder of this school of Buddhism is a figure named Bodhidharma. And according to the monks of Shaolin, this great teacher not only revolutionized Buddhist thought, but also single-handedly developed Kung Fu. Now, with Bodhidharma, there's a lot to unpack, so let's just start with the legend. According to tradition, Bodhidharma was the third son of a powerful South Indian king who ruled an empire that covers what are today the Indian states of Kerala and Tamil Nadu. Seeing that his son had a deep interest in spirituality, his father, the king, had him educated by a great Buddhist teacher named Prajnatara. Now, tradition has it that Prajnatara was 17 generations of students and teachers removed from the original Buddha. And apparently, every single one of those students and teachers had achieved enlightenment and themselves had become living Buddhas. Bodhidharma was the 18th in this series, going back to Siddhartha Gautama, the first Buddha. And what do you know? He too became enlightened. So if you go in for the Zen tradition, Bodhidharma is like the 18th Buddha. Now, one of the key ideas in Zen Buddhism, and something that seems to be echoed in many martial arts, is that enlightenment is something that can be transmitted directly from teacher to student. In Zen, the scriptures of Buddhism are de-emphasized in favor of deep meditation, introspection, and guidance from a master. Well, sometime around 480 AD, Bodhidharma's master declared that his student had indeed achieved enlightenment. So, soon after, Bodhidharma left India and traveled to China in order to spread his particular take on the teachings of the Buddha. Now, at the risk of going down a bit of a rabbit hole here explaining the finer points of Zen, let me just lay out a couple key ideas that I think are important to understand. Buddhism in general is about overcoming suffering and what Buddhists see as an endless cycle of death and rebirth. This is done by letting go of craving or desire. This can be the craving for status or money or material wealth. But it can also be our attachment to our own ego and our vain desire to not want to get old and die. When you finally completely overcome desire, then you will be enlightened and you will achieve what they call nirvana. Nirvana, in the Buddhist sense, is a perfect type of peace. It's often described as being snuffed out like a candle being blown out by the wind. Zen proposes that the best route towards nirvana is through meditation, with the goal of completely emptying your mind and embracing nothingness. Now, I think all this context is important if we're going to understand some of the best Bodhidharma stories. And I want to tell you a couple, just because one, they're super fun, and two, they give us a sense of Bodhidharma's character in legend. So there's this one great story about Bodhidharma meeting the Emperor of China. The devoutly Buddhist Wu Emperor called for an audience with Bodhidharma, a man he had been told was a great teacher of the Buddhist path. Their exchange apparently went something like this, and I'm going to put this in my own words. The emperor asked Bodhidharma, "Can you tell me how good my karma is? I've done so many great things. I've founded temples. I've had scriptures copied. I've supported monasteries. I've had images of the Buddha carved. I mean, I must have amazing karmic merit." And Bodhidharma says, "You have nothing. Good things done to score points in this life don't really get you anywhere." Now, the emperor is super confused. So he says, "Then what is the highest meaning of your noble truth?" And Bodhidharma says, "There is no noble truth, only emptiness." And the emperor goes, "Well, then who is standing in front of me then?" Bodhidharma just goes, "I don't know." I love that little story. And I think it tells us a lot about what Zen is about. But perhaps more importantly, it tells us what kind of a character Bodhidharma is in legend. He's presented as a holy fool who constantly reminds people around him that everything they care about is meaningless, and they just need to embrace the void. In art, he's usually given a bit of a comical appearance. He's got a pot belly, he's got wild hair and a disheveled beard. In another fun story, Bodhidharma wanders into the city of Nanjing, where he sees a huge crowd gathered around a monk named Shen Guan. Shen Guan had once been a warrior and a general, but he had renounced that life and was now teaching the ways of the Buddha. But Bodhidharma sensed that this guy hadn't really lost his violent warrior's heart. So as Shen Guan is preaching in the street, Bodhidharma comes up and sits down right in front of him. He then starts staring at him and just nodding in this super annoying and unsettling way. Eventually, this weird passive-aggressive display becomes too much for Shen Guan, who completely loses his temper and smacks Bodhidharma across the face with his prayer beads, knocking out two of Bodhidharma's front teeth. We're told that Bodhidharma just looked at him, grinned a big toothless grin, and then walked off. Shen Guan was amazed by this, so he followed after Bodhidharma. He eventually chased him all the way down to the banks of the Yangtze River, where he watched Bodhidharma step onto a single reed and effortlessly glide across the river. Shen Guan then tried to do it himself, but he fell into the river and nearly drowned. The lesson? Bodhidharma was not weighed down by craving, lust, and anger. Shen Guan clearly still was. So again, we see Bodhidharma, the holy fool, embarrassing a would-be student. I also love the image of a chubby Indian mystic gliding across the river on a single reed. Eventually, we're told that Bodhidharma made his way to the Shaolin Temple. In some versions of the story, Bodhidharma is turned away from Shaolin by the haughty monks. In other versions, the monks come to greet him, eager to receive his wisdom. But instead of coming inside, Bodhidharma marches up the nearby Mount Song, finds a cave, sits down, and starts meditating for the next 9 years, staring blankly at one of the cave walls. Then, about 7 years into his meditation, Bodhidharma falls asleep, which is a big no-no in Zen meditation. So, to keep it from happening again, we're told that Bodhidharma cut off both his eyelids so he could never close his eyes again. So you'll notice in all the traditional images of Bodhidharma that he always has these big, bulging eyes to signify that he has no eyelids. In one of the more fanciful versions of the story, we're told that when the severed eyelids fell to the earth, tea plants immediately sprung up in their place. And this was the origin of Chinese green tea. Now, this one's a little far-fetched, even for me. But if you're a true believer, then on top of founding Zen and inventing Kung Fu, Bodhidharma can also be credited with inventing China's most iconic drink. But it was after this 9 years of wall-gazing that Bodhidharma was said to have come down from the mountain and finally instructed the monks of Shaolin. It was at this time that Bodhidharma supposedly showed the monks a form of exercise derived from South Indian martial arts. These moves were known as the 18 Hands of Lohan. There are wall paintings in the Shaolin Temple that seem to commemorate this event. They depict a brown-skinned man with those distinctive bulging eyes instructing the Shaolin monks in hand-to-hand combat. In another version of the story, Bodhidharma comes down from the mountain, makes a brief pit stop at the Shaolin Temple, drops off a mysterious chest, and then disappears. When the monks open the chest, they find two books inside, one of which is the Yijin Jing. The Yijin Jing is essentially the original Kung Fu manual. It was one part deep philosophical text and another part exercise guidebook. So in some tellings, it was actually this book, allegedly authored by Bodhidharma, that really taught the Shaolin monks Kung Fu. In the book, there were a series of exercises, forms, and movements inspired by the natural world and various animals. The tiger, the crane, the praying mantis. You get the idea. According to one tradition, summarized by the Chinese historian Lin Buyan, the Shaolin monks, quote, selfishly coveted the book, practicing the skills therein, falling into heterodox ways, and losing the correct purpose of cultivating the way. The Shaolin monks have made some fame for themselves through their fighting skill. This was all due to having obtained this manuscript. End quote. Ooh, I kind of love that because it makes this book kind of sound like The Ring from Lord of the Rings. It gives you this immense power, but it will corrupt you. So, if the legend is to be believed, this encounter with Bodhidharma completely changed the monks of Shaolin. Not only did the temple become completely devoted to the way of Zen, or Chan Buddhism, the new exercises would transform these monks into men of iron. The fighting monks of Shaolin were born. From there, Kung Fu spread through the rest of China. But it was always known that the purest form of the art was always practiced at Shaolin. Okay, so does this story contain any truth at all? Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's look at the evidence. first thing that strikes me about the Bodhidharma story is that it's wildly inconsistent and varies greatly depending on the source. Consider this. One of the most popular traditions about Bodhidharma was that his arms and legs withered away from disuse while he was meditating on Mount Song. In a lot of art, Bodhidharma is represented as just a big cloaked torso with huge bulging eyes. So, you know, that doesn't really sound like a guy who's going to come down from the mountain and lead martial arts classes. In fact, most Bodhidharma legends are about him being super inactive. In one famous story, instead of teaching a group of students, he just meditates in front of them, potentially imparting the lesson that embracing emptiness is the point. Also, Bodhidharma's teaching, like most Buddhist teaching, is deeply opposed to violence. In fact, there's a whole subgenre of Bodhidharma stories about that monk Shengguan that I mentioned earlier. Their whole relationship is about Bodhidharma teaching this monk to let go of his warrior's temper and violent impulses. So in many ways, the whole kung fu thing doesn't fit with the rest of the Bodhidharma legend. Bodhidharma being really into hand-to-hand combat just feels out of place. Now, I should say that the Shaolin monks have come up with elaborate theological explanations to demonstrate how martial arts is actually a form of meditation and is therefore completely compatible with Buddhism. But honestly, from a storytelling angle, the martial arts training just seems inconsistent. But with Bodhidharma, it's worth asking whether he was even a real person. As many of you know, finding evidence outside of religious sources to confirm the existence of ancient religious figures can sometimes be tricky. In the case of Bodhidharma, most scholars seem comfortable with the idea that someone like him existed in the 5th century. There are enough primary sources that speak of a wandering Buddhist teacher named Bodhidharma that most experts believe he probably was a real guy. But beyond the simple fact of his existence, very little else can be confirmed. Some scholars even question if Bodhidharma had anything to do with the creation of Zen. The historian Meir Shahar, who is one of the most widely published English language experts on the Shaolin Temple, has pointed out that Zen, or Chan Buddhism, only emerged in China a century after Bodhidharma's death, and then it only really becomes a force in Chinese Buddhism in the 8th century, some 300 years after Shaolin's alleged visit from Bodhidharma. So, it was probably these newly relevant Zen teachers in the 700s who ginned up the reputation of Bodhidharma. Shahar explains that the Zen belief that enlightenment was transmitted from student to teacher meant that these 8th century teachers needed to establish their credibility by tracing their lineage all the way back to the first Buddha. Bodhidharma became an essential link in a chain that they were forging back to the founder of the religion. Shahar writes, quote, "Therefore, in the course of the 8th century, Chan authors furnished their schools with a past. They manufactured a genealogy of Chinese and further back Indian patriarchs who connected them to the source of the Buddhist faith. Chan authors focused on a particular patriarch they believed brought the tradition from India to China. They assigned this role to the obscure Bodhidharma." End quote. So, according to Shahar, Bodhidharma was assigned the role of founder of Zen Buddhism by dudes in the 8th century. From there, Bodhidharma's legend seems to grow. In the medieval period, each subsequent text recounting Bodhidharma's life seems to add new details. In the earliest texts, Bodhidharma isn't even clearly identified as being from India. The first text in which he appears, which is called The Record of the Buddhist Monasteries of Luoyang from the mid-6th century, describes Bodhidharma as, quote, a monk of the Western region, a Persian Central Asian, end quote. It's only later accounts where he is specifically identified as the third son of a South Indian king. So, you know, who knows? Maybe the guy's not even from India. Anyway, it was in the late 7th century that the mountain near Shaolin Temple, Mount Song, became associated with Zen Buddhism. It was at that time that the famous and more historically verifiable Zen masters Fa Wu and Wei Yan took up residence at the Shaolin Monastery. It's the opinion of Meir Shahar that these men were responsible for connecting Bodhidharma to the Shaolin Temple and the holy peak of Mount Song. They were really responsible for making Shaolin a Zen or Chan monastery. But Zen being Zen, it's always better if you have an even more distant, even more eminent predecessor. So they took Bodhidharma, pumped up his legend, and connected him to their chosen monastery. So in all likelihood, Bodhidharma didn't come up with Zen Buddhism and probably never visited the Shaolin Monastery, let alone taught them martial arts. But what about that book, the Yijin Jing? How do we explain that thing? Well, part of the reason it is believed to have been written by Bodhidharma are thanks to two prefaces that appear at the start of the surviving manuscripts. These prefaces are supposedly from the 7th and 12th centuries, respectively, and are credited to well-known Chinese generals. Both of these prefaces tell the tale that the book was left at the Shaolin Temple by Bodhidharma. But experts have pointed out that these prefaces are riddled with anachronisms and inconsistencies that make it clear that both of them are forgeries written much later in history. Again, I turn to Meir Shahar, who's quite confident that the book was written no earlier than 1624, a solid millennium after Bodhidharma's time. The Japanese martial arts scholar Ryushi Matsuda, who did extensive research into the origins of Chinese martial arts, found no references to Bodhidharma creating Shaolin Kung Fu before the 1800s. So, let's recap. The story that Bodhidharma visited the Shaolin Temple in the 400s and got the monks on board with his new Zen philosophy is a story that was probably cooked up in the late 600s. The little add-on that he also invented Kung Fu while he was there was probably concocted in the 1600s at the earliest. And then that story didn't really catch on until the 1800s. So in this sense, Bodhidharma inventing Kung Fu is almost a modern myth. So then I'm sure you're asking, where did Kung Fu really come from? Well, the answer is pretty unexciting. It developed slowly over the course of centuries, incorporating and innovating on other indigenous martial arts forms from China. The Shaolin Monastery seems to have incorporated a military element into their training since the foundation of China's Tang Dynasty in the early 600s. In fact, part of the reason Shaolin was able to flourish and became one of the richest monasteries in China was thanks to the fact that the monks had gone to war for the first Tang Emperor and played a small role in helping him secure the throne of China. The temple enjoyed royal patronage for a number of centuries thanks to the monks' military clout. So the whole warrior monk thing, that is no myth. The Buddhist prohibition on violence notwithstanding, The monks of Shaolin were picking up weapons and engaging in warfare almost from the very beginning. But the martial art associated with the temple did not appear fully formed in the 5th century. It evolved steadily over time and probably found a form close to what we would recognize today in the 16th or 17th century. But the legend of Shaolin as the birthplace of Asia's most prestigious martial arts system would prove incredibly potent. As time went on and new and different forms of martial arts started to be developed in East Asia, being able to trace the genesis of your art back to the Shaolin Temple, well, was almost mandatory. If your fighting style was at all going to be taken seriously, it needed to be dusted with the prestige of Shaolin. The irony, of course, being that Shaolin's own prestige was buttressed by an elaborately manufactured past. The Bodhidharma legend was the fake that launched a thousand myths, and as the schools of martial arts started to multiply, so too did the fake history. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will continue our look at the weird history of martial arts. Before we go this week, I'd like to give a shout out to the following people. Big ups to Michelle Doege, to Clinton Freeman, to Josh Morrill, to Christopher Patterson, to Paul Menard, to Benjamin Bernier, to Juliana Longo, to Ian DeJong, to Benjamin Varner, to Ole Tobias Mosty, or is that Ole Tobias Mosty? I think it's Ole Tobias Mosty, not Ole Tobias. It's got to be Ole Tobias Mosty. To Wyatt Ferguson, to Caitlin Lambert, to Carlton Wheeler, to Bradley Hood, to Aaron Kristoff, to Chris Lindstrom, and to Orien Nielsen. All of these people are supporting at $5 or more every month on Patreon. So you know what that means. They're beautiful human beings. Thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who's supporting the show on Patreon, to everyone doing one-off donations through OurFakeHistory.com, to everyone else that's just listening and supporting the show and maybe writing nice reviews here or there. I appreciate it all. Thank you so much. Also, if you've been supporting for the show for a while at $5 or more and you haven't heard your name in the shoutouts, please let me know. Sometimes I miss them. I'm so sorry if I've missed your name. So just let me know and I'll make sure I get you a specific shoutout because you deserve it. As always, if you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. I got a bunch of emails to catch up on right now, actually. You can hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/ourfakehistory. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory. And now you can also follow me on Instagram at ourfakehistory. The theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out more from Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. And all the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.
Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.